It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
So I've won you over.
You most certainly have not.
Oh, yes, I have. You see that it's too risky for me to go to Tom's Hat by daylight, so what do you do?
Not a thing.
You persuade me to send a deserted mill until dark, and then you return and drive me over to Tom's Hat before it closes. I feel like Bonnie Prince Charlie. You must be Flora McDonald.
A little while ago, I was Florence Nightingale.
That's what I like about you. You're different.
How can you joke about this? Don't you know what it means if you're caught?
I can make a rough guess. Horribly rough.
Well, it isn't funny, is it?
No, but I can laugh because I'm innocent. You don't believe that, do you? I wish you did. Well, what are you going to do?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? Oh, I mean, Is It Psycho? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am here with the usual Is It Psycho team, which would include Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here, buddy.
Mr. Trey Hooks.
Hello.
And Mr. Blaine Dowler.
How are you doing?
All is well. And today we are looking at our next Alfred Hitchcock film, which is Young and Innocent. I need to confess, I never even heard of this movie before you told us that we should do it on here. I've always fancied myself as a Hitchcock fan, and I am certainly a fan of Hitchcock's work. But I'm learning as we do this that I don't have nearly the full background coming into this of his work that I thought I did. I'm really glad that we're doing this because it allows me the chance to see these movies that I hadn't seen and in this case had heard of. And for this, I got the DVD from the library. Interestingly, it was introduced, and it was actually bookended because he was at the very end as well, by Tony Curtis on the DVD, which I thought was an interesting touch. I watched that. I will get into my thoughts about it. Then I found myself going onto YouTube, and I was watching a 10-minute documentary by a film writer about it. And then lastly, I watched it a second time on YouTube in a colorized version. And I'm just going to quickly say it must have been in the infancy of colorization because there were a lot of not so great attempts and times when instead of colorizing, they would let the blacks and grays of the original kind of come through in a thought that, you know, that would look right, and it didn't. But what it did do was in the scenes that were colorized nicely, if you took a still shot of him, it showed me some of the beauty of some of the shots that Hitchcock did that I did not quite appreciate in black and white. So I'm glad I watched it in a colorized version, even though I think it was a poorly colorized version. So that's my first thoughts on it. And let's go around the table. Sean?
Yeah, like you, this was, well, I heard of it only because I'd seen enough lists of Hitchcock's films, so that there was that piece. But this is one I've never saw. I didn't know the premise of it. I didn't know the storyline behind it. So this was really fresh for me. I ended up buying the DVD off of Amazon. They had a reprint from, I think it was Starlight Productions or something like that. It was like $9 or something like that. And I watched it that way. It was exciting to watch this one, just because I like walking into films when I don't know anything. I think nowadays, and I talked about this on another episode that we did, I think nowadays trailers sometimes reveal way too much of the film. And I loved this one was just really, really fresh for me. And it'll be fun to talk about this one just as interesting for viewing.
Trey?
Yeah, similar to both of you, I saw this for the first time on DVD this go around. What I like about the early British Hitchcocks is kind of what you said, Sean. You don't know what you're going to get. You can't assume that you're going to get the same thrillers that he would become known for. So I really enjoyed going into this one fresh.
Blaine?
So it sounds like I'm the only one that had seen this previously. When I was first introduced to Hitchcock
Sounds like it.
in film studies, the local drugstore had two Hitchcock DVD box sets with all of his British films, which are now public domain. So it cost me 15, $20 to have his entire British repertoire. Since then, I have purchased upgraded editions of a lot of them because when you've got a cheap release of 10 public domain films, they tend to not be the greatest quality. So this one I'm still watching in that release. It's not, you know, Man Who Knew Too Much or The 39 Steps, Lady Vanishes, The Lodger. I would say of his 19 British films, there's five or six that have maintained their presence in sort of film circles. This is one of the ones where you watch it if you've decided to watch all Hitchcock. It's not one of the ones that really grabs a lot of attention. Of the ones that are well known, I'd say it's probably closest to The 39 Steps, which came out 2 years prior, but that's for a later part. But yeah, so I first saw this close to 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, just trying to go through all of Hitchcock's repertoire, and then cracked it out to watch it a second time for this podcast.
Okay. I found this movie to be enjoyable as I watched it. And I have to say, I actually enjoyed it much more on the second go round. I'm not sure exactly the reason, because it certainly wasn't the stunning visuals, because the colorization was pulling me out of it a little bit. But I found the performances felt more crisp the second time I watched it. I don't know why. I think maybe because I was focusing more on what was happening on the screen and less on just trying to figure out where they're going to go and how they were going to do it. I let it take me away and ride with it the second time. I think that's the difference. And I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed that in 1937, Hitchcock made the female protagonist exceptionally strong. I liked the fact that it was your traditional man on the run Hitchcock story, which I think became even more so later. But after the 39 Steps, that was already one of his stylistic things. But it was a little bit different. There wasn't, you know, like the spies or anything. You know, there wasn't a greater thing. He was being accused of murder, and that was it. That was the only aspect of it. The other thing about it that really stood out to me, and I think we're going to have to talk about it more at length, is very late in the movie, there's a shot that technically is phenomenal that they completed it back in 1937, back in a day when they didn't have computers, back in the day when the camera was so much more or so much less sophisticated. There is a dolly shot where they pull in closer, 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 closer till you have an extreme close up and it stays in focus the entire time. It just is perfectly done. It brings your eyes to exactly what you have to see. I think it's one of Hitchcock's master moments. And again, I think we're going to need to discuss that.
It took them 2 days to
do. Performances were great. Well, you know what? 2 days to do is not really that crazy when you think about it. 2 days is fast, actually, I think, for a shot of that complexity. Yeah. I don't know how they possibly kept focused the way they did.
Yeah. Well, for that,
you know, if you had the camera, go ahead.
In these days, really, the cameraman would have just been manually adjusting the focus the whole dolly track.
And to do so correctly the whole time is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes very precise planning and, Hitchcock is renowned for his extreme planning beforehand, that he's not looking for any ad libs. He's not looking for any, last minute changes in the script or in the camera movements. So I'm sure he had that shot very, very carefully mapped out and set up. But again, I was very, very impressed by it. Any initial thoughts on the technical aspects of the movie?
I would agree that shot stands out the most. Actually, when Truffaut interviewed him, he said he'd seen the movie when it was new, and when they interviewed him 20 years later, that was the only shot he clearly remembered. So I find, tactically speaking, he's very capable. That shot was the one that was innovative, right? The rest of it is, it's good, it's well made, but it wasn't breaking new ground relative, even to the 39 steps a couple of years before. I'm pretty sure the studio said, hey, can we replicate that success? And Hitchcock's personal challenge was to make the protagonist a young female. That's what he wanted to do that was different from the rest, which is why when it was released in America, they titled it The Girl Was Young.
I find to be The Girl Was Young to just be a terrible title for the movie.
Yep.
Speaking of which, she was 17 years old when they filmed this.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yep. And Metro.
He was 31. She was 17.
Yeah. And another person on set who's in the close-up holding her hands out when she's in the mine. They met on set and they would marry in 1939. And stay married until his death.
Yeah, she had a relatively short film career. I think she was done by the 1940s and finished being in movies. She had been in the running to be in Rebecca, but apparently the studio overruled Hitchcock's thoughts on them. Mm-hmm. She had a chance. I think she had an opportunity to be a major Hollywood star, but she wanted to. Apparently, she wanted to limit herself to British productions, and I guess limited herself. Period, as far as being in films, because she had a very short film career. Although she lived to be, I think it was close to 100.
Yeah, it would have been about 95 then, because I know she passed away in 2015 and was the last credited cast member to pass away. She might have been survived by some of the kids at the birthday party, but they weren't credited on screen, so it's way harder to track.
If she even was.
Yeah.
That would be somewhat questionable. I mean, it's not like by the time she passed away, it's not like they were that young. She was only, probably less than 10 years older than those kids.
Yeah. So and she made it to 95. So yeah, she probably would have outlived several of them, but just perhaps not all. Okay.
And so I thought the story is based on a novel that came out, I think, 2 years earlier, which is a pretty quick turnaround back then. I understand that there are some significant changes. Probably the of which is that the belt, which is so key in the movie, was not really a major plot point in the novel. I know, Blaine, you said you had read about the changes, so I thought maybe we'd take a look at that.
Yeah, in that one, it wasn't a belt, it was a button from a coat that was missing. It's one of the Inspector Grant series of novels, so the main protagonist is a recurring detective who does not appear in the film. And, you know, there's a difference in terms of who was actually guilty of it. So they're... I read the plot synopsis on Wikipedia, and it sounds like there are some set pieces that Hitchcock kept. So the initial setup that this famous actress was murdered on the beach in what some people think is a drowning accident, but they figured, no, this was murder because of, you know, she's got defensive wounds. She's got this button tangled in her hair. So Inspector Grant starts investigating. There's a 16-year-old girl who tracks down the stolen coat because she believes the guy who says it. So she finds his coat, which had been stolen, and all the buttons were intact. So it's only later that they actually find the missing coat. But
yeah. I thought the plot itself differed in some ways from the traditional Hitchcock, because I don't think there was ever much mystery about who actually committed the murder. No. I think, you know, you had that opening scene where mm-hmm. you saw her arguing with her ex-husband, and then, you know, you don't see him again until late in the film, but, you know, we have our protagonist who's accused of the murder, and I think it became very clear very quickly that the guy we had seen was the guy who actually killed her. So then it just became a question of, can they track him down and find him and find proof of it, even though they didn't know who did it. There were some plot elements in this that I thought were a little convenient. You know, the fact that he had a history with her, that she left money to him in her will. You know, I thought some of that just seemed a little bit to just make you question the validity of it, because it's so coincidental. But that aside, I think the key to this movie, and I think it's more so than most of these Hitchcock, Man on the Run movies, is the relationship between the two main characters felt like it developed over time. It felt more real to me than a lot of them.
Did you feel like, rom-com is maybe going too far, but did you feel like Hitchcock was bringing kind of a comedy aspect into it? The way the lead character kind of flirted, almost in that Cary Grant way of just, you know, popping up out of nowhere and puppy dog following her, and a lot of their exchanges weren't like the Carol Lombard type patter that you might expect, but they were very cute, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think you're right to say it's not rom-com, but I definitely think there was a comedy level on this movie. On the non-romantic end, I thought the interaction with him and his court-appointed lawyer was mm-hmm. quite amusing. I thought the bumbling police that were going after them when they were in that barn, and then they like slipped down and actually kicked them while they were coming down, I thought there was some comedy elements to that. And then, yeah, I do think some of their exchanges had a comic undertone. I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't over the top at all, but I definitely think that there was more of an effort to make it lighthearted. This movie did not feel like a, you know, like a real serious, you need to be concerned for the people type thing.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit on the light side with that. So again, I don't think they were diving in. It's not Mr. and Mrs. Smith where the comedy is the goal.
But no.
There were some moments of tension relief to try and build a relationship between them.
What did you think of her performance? Did she come off to you as believable?
She, I, found it actually fairly impressive at the time. She felt natural. I mean, I, like you, I read afterwards that she was 17 at the time of filming. I would have guessed early 20s from watching that performance, because she carried herself with a confidence and maturity that you wouldn't typically expect from a 17-year-old. So I mean, she definitely is young. And like I said, I was watching a public domain fuzzy copy from second or third generation. So the film wasn't as sharp as it could have been. So it kind of blurred the ages on everybody. But yeah, I think she could have had a much longer career ahead of her had she chosen to do so.
I struggled with the style of acting in this one, just to be honest. I felt like the performances were more, I felt like it was stage actors who were struggling to transition to film acting. It felt, if you had told me that this film had been made 4 years earlier and had been sitting on a shelf, I'd believe it. These did not feel like 1937 performances. They felt like 1931 performances. So I struggled with them a little bit, to be honest.
See, I get where you come from, and I thought that he might have had a little bit more of that than she did. I thought her performance came off much stronger. You know, the age thing, it's just an interesting thing. I wonder back in 1937 if it was obvious that she was, you know, 18-ish.
Right.
Because the styles were different then, and I routinely look at images from the 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s of teenagers and think, my God, they look so old in that picture. I can't believe their ages. So, and that's really just the styles of the day. So it's interesting to kind of take that and look at that. But the performance itself, I thought the character had a lot of credibility to her. You know, her, you know, comes in and she's basically taking care of him after he faints, and she's showing that she knows all these different things, that she's knowledgeable beyond her years right from the start. And I'm not sure she's supposed to be 18 in it, but she's living with a father. She's got her little brothers. So I quite possibly she is. And maybe he's supposed to be, instead of 31, maybe he's supposed to be 25, 26, somewhere around there. So, you know, I don't think the age difference is supposed to be scandalous in any way. I think, you know, there is a slight age difference. But he also had a youngish-looking face. So I don't think that, again, I think it was very easy for him to pass for, you know, years younger than he really was. I thought the romance kind of moved along slowly enough. It felt believable, more, again, like I said earlier, more believable to me than in a lot of movies of this nature where, you know, the couple is put together by circumstances. They didn't know each other. And by the end, you know, you think they're going to live happily ever after, you know, 3 hours later in movie time. So in this one, they don't even necessarily give you the impression that they're going to get married and live together, but they are now effectively a couple. That's all. I think that's as far as they go.
Their chemistry was pretty much a key for me, because I didn't feel like kind of everything that's been said here. I didn't feel like I was blown away by the performances, but I did feel like I liked them. I liked them together. I liked them as a couple, because I felt like the premise that she thought that he was innocent. I didn't know that. I didn't feel like that got fully developed. So you have to believe there's something between the two of them that would make her want to believe in him. And I did feel like the two of them were well cast together. And that was something that stood out for me in this. Because if they're not likable, this film falls apart.
I agree, and I think why I bought her believing his innocence, and this goes to what you were saying earlier about some of the plot points, Paul, but I think you can kind of view some of them as a strength, is the case against him was so flimsy. I mean, yes, there was the prior relationship, but, you know, what physical evidence made that his belt from his raincoat? Nothing, right?
No, it's the circumstantial evidence of him running from the scene of the body. That's really the key against him. And the fact that he did have a prior relationship with her, so you can tie in that they, you know, it's not just a random guy.
Well, but you could also have flipped the coin and said, this older man's telling the truth. I trust him over these two younger women. I mean, in terms of who found the body first. So,
yeah, that there could be the recency bias, which is a psychological thing where the version you hear first is more likely to be believed when there are circumstantial differences. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the other people actually said, oh, yeah, he has a coat with a belt like that. So there was a third witness saying, yeah, we've seen him in a similar coat. There was the inheritance left, which, I mean, yeah, I think, Paul, you're right when you say it's coincidental. Reading the synopsis of the novel it's based on, that's where that came from. So the evidence against him was pretty much preserved, aside from it being a button instead of a belt. Other than that, it was the same circumstantial case. Reading that synopsis, because Inspector Grant was a much bigger character, he wasn't as convinced. Like, he, based on the synopsis, it sounds like Grant recognized it was circumstantial. It was just, you know, the only leads he had. So he didn't have another suspect to look at. So that's still why the guy got the most focus, but he was never, you know, 100% convinced on board. It's like, oh, this is the guy, I got to get him. It's more like, eh, this is an avenue worth exploring.
I think they also show the police to be kind of lazy in their investigation of what went on. You know, they just kind of say, yeah, you know, we got him. We don't have to look any further. They don't bother listening to what he has to say and investigating for that. I found one character to be charm his own way was the hobo, Willie, who was it? He was a china repair man. Mm-hmm. He would repair pieces of china, which I think probably was a more common thing back then. You know, I don't think it was as common for regular people to have, you know, a fancy set of dishes and a regular set of dishes. I think they had a set of dishes, and when things broke, you couldn't just run out and buy a whole new set, because that just wasn't the way of things. So to have somebody whose specialty is to repair your china for you, that made sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I found his character to be fun. What do you say? I'm looking for a bloke what twitches. You know? and then when he's trying to dance, I mean, there's just so many fun things about him in general.
Likeability is a key thing in this, because I saw like some early parts of what I really like about North by Northwest in this. Just as far as, you know, the adventure thread of this one. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my enjoyment of this film was really carried over the fact that these are people I enjoyed hanging out with. Enjoyable is probably a word I'm going to use way too much in this conversation, but I felt like that was my vibe through this whole, both viewings of this. And I actually agree with something you said earlier, Paul, about how you enjoyed your second viewing more. I found the same thing, and I think it's because I like the people that I was hanging out with more than anything else, which is an interesting sort of thread. I don't know there was so much the storyline as much as the fact that I found that the cast was very likable, and I believed that there was some connection between them.
He seemed uncommonly calm with the threat of a murder rap on his hanging over his head as he escaped as he escaped custody, and as he just was, you know, he had a drop him off at the barn. He goes to sleep under the hay. It just seemed like he was nowhere near as frantic as your average person would be in those circumstances. But I thought that added to the charm of the movie, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well, their plan, like, I could see why someone would kind of think of it, but their plan ultimately makes no sense in that. I mean, yes, there could have been a world where they got the coat and the belt was there, but there's like no chain of custody of that evidence, right? Like, well, you're telling me this is your coat. How do I know this is your coat, or that you didn't just go grab a belt off of another coat? You know, so they were pretty naive in thinking, oh, we'll find this coat that will instantly clear you of any wrongdoing.
But I think there's something to be said for that as well, because they're not criminologists. They're looking at this from the point of view of a person who thinks, you know, everything's black and white. And, you know, once I find the coat, that's it. It'll prove that it was not my belt, and therefore I couldn't have killed her. And, you know, like you say, what's to say, you know, how do you prove that, first of all, the belt you're showing them is actually your belt? And what's to say that you didn't have another belt or something? You know, you still have the fact that you had a prior relationship with her and you were seen running from her body. You know, that's pretty strong evidence against him as far as circumstantial goes. Mm. It may not be enough to convict him, but I do think it's enough to arrest him.
Yeah, I would agree. And on that basis, remember, right, they're working for the defense, not the prosecution. So they just need to raise reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I've been rewatching Matlock for other reasons. And there's a couple of times where he said, oh, I don't need to prove that you did it. I just need to raise a reasonable doubt. And right, yeah. That could be enough to raise a reasonable doubt, because that evidence against him was so circumstantial in the first place.
I think the biggest kind of coincidental plot hole, and I know you only read the synopsis, Blaine, so I don't know how it really plays out in the book, but there's an inference of premeditation on the murderer's part that doesn't make sense because of the coincidentalness of how he could have gotten the raincoat. Because Robert had to forget and leave his raincoat at the diner. Old Will had to pick it up and take it. Guy had to find Old Will, know that it was Robert's raincoat, buy it from Old Will, and then use it to kill the woman at the beginning, or, you know, lay it to place blame. And it's like, okay, there's no way you would plan a murder that way at all.
Yeah. Well, reading the summary of the novel, the guilty party in the novel is not even a character in the movie. So they did make some substantial changes. I don't know if I want to reveal who it is, because it might tip things. But yeah,
I think you should reveal it, because it's not like any of us are going to read the novel at this point anyway.
Okay. So if any listeners are planning to read it, maybe skip ahead a bit. In the novel, they find out that even though the actress was supposed to be there in secret, the landlord did let it slip in the hair salon that there was the famous actress here, and a local psychic predicted, or who was in the room, then came out with a prediction saying, oh, you know, she's an astrologer, she's trying to build her business, and oh, warning, a famous actress is going to die in a drowning incident. And then it was that psychic that went and killed her just to make herself famous. They had no prior relationship. She just knew, oh, this is a famous actress I have access to, this will make the news, that she predicts it accurately. And so when Inspector Grant finds out that would slip when he was getting his own hair cut in that salon, he checks out the astrologer's motorboat and finds the coat with the missing button there, and confronts her, and she confesses.
It's very interesting, actually. It's yet another case, and it's I think it's such a rare thing where and I didn't read the novel, so you can't, you know, you can't take this as gospel. But it sounds to me like this is one of the rare cases where movie's plot and storyline exceeds the novel or is better than the novel. Even though I've criticized some of the coincidental aspects of this, I suspect those coincidental aspects pretty much exist in the novel as well. Yeah. And yet they're adding in that, you know, sensationalist moment to it for the psychic, which I don't think adds to the plot at all. I think having it be her disgruntled ex-husband who did it, you know, and the fact that he was a bloke what has a twitch, I think that was a good plot point, and I like the fact that they did it that way. So I think I prefer what they actually did. Yeah. Any thoughts?
No, it's again, the way it's described in the synopsis, I would agree that the movie probably handled it better than just a fame-seeking astrologer. And part of that is because I am so skeptical of astrology and psychic beliefs that, you know, I'm trying to figure out if I remember the public or a police officer who was investigating it and said, oh, a psychic made this prediction. Well, maybe the psychic made it happen, and that would have bumped her right to the top of the suspect list just because I don't believe in that stuff. So it would have been oh, that's not a heck of a coincidence. Yeah. I wouldn't believe in the astrology. I'd say, okay, are you the one who did it to promote yourself?
Yeah. It doesn't sound like much of a mystery to me, actually. But, you know, I mean, there's ways that could be done and presented in a very, very, you know, very competent fashion. I think if you were to present that as the character and the motivation, and as the reader, you know that from the start, it's not a mystery. But it's it's almost the Columbo method, where we're going to have the mystery out there, but it's not a mystery to the viewer. It's a mystery to the people on the screen, and you're just watching it to figure out how they solve it. Then I think that could work.
Yeah, the inverted mystery.
But if it's, you know, yes, you know, I never heard it put in that term, but I like that, the inverted mystery. I think that works for me.
Yeah, and even some of the things like the movie, that coat with the missing belt was a huge part. The synopsis of the novel on Wikipedia is a 14 paragraph summary. And the missing coat is mentioned for the first time in paragraph 6. And then his coat was tracked down and discovered and helped clear him in paragraph 7. So it does not seem anywhere near as protracted. And it's just, yeah, Erica believed him. So she went and found it out. And then the rest of the action is all about Inspector Grant.
Well, so that's where I'm torn, and I won't give my rating yet, but I don't think I enjoyed this as much as the rest of the three of you. I think a lot of my problems with it are coming at it from a modern lens in terms of what. Like, for me, a big part of my issues are why everyone suddenly laser focuses on this one guy, and I understand the circumstantial evidence, but, you know, the woman has a husband, and evidently the husband goes missing because he goes underground because he's afraid of being caught, and that's not a plot point at all, even until the very end. But at the same time, you have to do that to make this story with this focus work. So maybe I'm expecting the book without even having known the book, because my brain thinks that because the book might have covered a lot of the holes that I'm seeing from a plot perspective in terms of a mystery. But if you did that story cannot focus on these two characters, because they would be minor characters in that story.
Yeah, because this is about this guy proving his innocence as one of the suspects. If you're going to have it viable from the detective's perspective, there have to be more suspects, as the synopsis says there were. It's just, like I said, the ultimate solution only works if you think psychic phenomenon are a valid option.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you on that plane. I'm not a believer in psychic phenomena. I think, you know, when you have these famous TV psychics and whatever, that it's always some sort of gimmick involved. But that's my own personal take. Some people believe it very, very much. So I'm not feeling the need to criticize any of them for their beliefs. I'm going to throw out to you guys what might be viewed as some as a controversy in the movie. And I'm going to just refrain from giving my opinion until I get what you guys think. But what did you think of the fact that we end, or we almost come to the very end, at a minstrel show?
I didn't have a problem with it for two reasons. One is, I'm pretty sure you've covered other films that have had this in there, Paul, but minstrel shows were a thing all the way up until at least the 50s. There was a television show that ran into the 70s in Britain that was called The Minstrel Show, that still had people performing in blackface. So it was era appropriate. And again, it may not make sense from the perspective of the focus of the story, but from a plot perspective, the husband was in that band in blackface to be hidden.
Yeah, that's kind of what I saw too. It was a thing. I mean, it would be like if you had a play written in America prior to the American Civil War, you might have slaves showing up in that play when the play is not about the racism and slavery.
Yeah.
This is a similar thing. Mm-hmm. It's an activity that probably should have never happened, but when the film was made, it was happening fairly routinely. And like Trey said, it gave him a form of mask to wear that would not have stood out to the crowd as a disguise. So I think if they were to adapt it today, given that that wasn't in the source novel, it was created for the film, I think they would make a different choice. But audiences, mm-hmm. or the target audiences in 1937 would not have viewed it as an issue.
I agree 100%. I found that it was not offensive because it is historically accurate. The lack of offense isn't because that I think it was okay for them to do those things. The lack of offense is because they did do those things, and it is historically accurate. So, you know, if this movie took place in 25, clearly they wouldn't do that. They might have him, you know, at an amusement park with a costume on where his face was covered. I don't know. You know, I'm that far afield, but I didn't think it was offensive because I did think it fit the plot. And I hadn't even really considered that it added to his ability to be, you know, incognito. Because I really, though he was on the run or he was trying to avoid, you know, the spotlight, I don't think he was aware that anyone was actually looking for him until he saw old Wilson watching the show. And then that caused him to have a panic attack, which ultimately caused him to, I guess, have a heart attack.
I think where it worked for me is it wasn't put in the film to be social commentary. It wasn't put in the film to make a statement. Mm-hmm. It wasn't put in the film to be offensive. It was matter of fact. It was just, this is the era. This is what would happen in that era. It's a piece of the time. I totally agree with Blaine that, like, if they shot this today, there's no way they'd do that. But, you know, back then, that would be really common. I think if they did do it today, I think they'd have to be very cautious as far as how you're putting in the film, so it doesn't take away from the film. I think it would have become much more of a story. Whereas back then, it was done because that's just the way things were then. And it served, as far as the story goes, it did serve as an appropriate vehicle away from, I like the idea, because I do agree, it was a way for him to hide.
If you did it today, you would either put him in some kind of death metal band where they've got all the makeup on, or maybe some kind of avant-garde performance art piece to where, similarly, he'd be like heavily made up. But that was a reason why, that was an in-story reason for the era, why someone would be out in public yeah. with heavy makeup to where, you know, it would help disguise you. And no one would think twice about you walking around with the heavy makeup on.
Yeah. And it's also a kind of disguise that would reveal the eye twitch. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. True. If they made this movie today and they made it as a period piece taking place in 1937 and decided to keep minstrel show as part of the plot points or part of the narrative, I think they would have to add in one of the patrons at the show saying, oh, that's horrible that they do that. Why do they do that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd have to throw in a little expository language just to one, explain to 2025 viewers that this was something that went, and two, to express at least, you know, through a third party, some sort of outrage over the fact that it did exist. I think you'd need to have that moment in there. But otherwise, you could, you know, you could make this as a period piece and maintain that as long as you added that.
I think there are a lot of other films, and one that's jumping in my head is like Holiday Inn and White Christmas, where if you decided to remake those, you'd have a much harder time trying to keep the minstrel show pieces from those in, because they really weren't story driven. You know what I mean? Whereas,
yes.
Whereas here, if you did it today, I don't think you would still keep it as a minstrel show, but I think you could still do a similar thing, and it might be needed because it is story driven.
I thought, and again, it was by far the key innovative shot in the movie. And I tend to think of it as similar to what the reputation is for James Cameron, where his reputation is that he writes scripts that he can't film because the current state of technology can't handle what he's asking it to do. And then he waits for technology to catch up to him before he films them. Mm-hmm. And I think in his own way, this might've been Hitchcock saying, I'm going to make this movie, but I want to do something in it that has never been done before. And I think that's what I felt about that shot, because I don't think there's ever been anything before that where they did a similar shot. So I'm going back to it, but I'm just really impressed by the ability to do that back in 1937. I personally didn't have any strong thoughts with regard to the score in the movie. I don't know if any of you did.
No.
Mm-mm.
So that said, do we have anything else that we need to touch on? Well, we could touch on where's Alfred. Mm-hmm. Everybody see his cameo? Because it struck me as very, very obvious.
I was going to say, I feel like out of the different ones we've covered so far, he was on the screen kind of in plain sight the longest in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was the length of time that he was on that made it really obvious. I think if they had, you know, if it had been like a panning and he just was in the crowd, then you might not have noticed him. But since it like focused on that particular static shot for, I don't know, 2-3 seconds, whatever it was, but it was long enough for him to just, you know, for you to say, well, why are they showing me this? Oh, look, there's Alfred right there.
Yeah. So if anyone in the audience did miss it, it's around the 15 to 16 minute mark. He's a photographer at the courthouse when our suspect manages to escape by stealing his lawyer's glasses.
I do find it amazing that he didn't look all that different in 1937 than he did in like 1967. You know, when you see him in these movies, he looks the same. which I again, I find that.
Yeah, amazing. Well, it's like Patrick Stewart. If you see him when he appeared on Coronation Street in 1962, moving film footage doesn't exist. But there's a 20-some year, like early 20s Patrick Stewart. He has not changed. I mean, people comment about how he hasn't aged since the 80s. No, he hasn't aged to the 60s because he did all of his aging between like 17 and 20. He went bald at 19. He was just born old, and now his age is catching up with where he actually is.
This is kind of topical right now because of when we are recording this. For anyone who wants to give guff about Clark Kent and Superman in the glasses, in this film, a suspected murderer walks past the police out of the courtroom where he's supposed to be on trial wearing nothing but a pair of glasses. The Superman Clark Kent thing works. Yeah,
which, by the way, remember, this is a 1937 film, so Superman and Clark Kent weren't doing that yet. And even when the comics did come out in the very near future, one of Superman's powers was incredible muscular control. So Superman and Clark Kent actually had two different faces in the late 30s.
And they've played on that trope numerous times, including in the movie that just came out where they say, oh, you know, he's hypnotizing people, which actually comes from the comics as well. But I kind of accepted that in this movie by saying to myself, well, it is 1937, so there isn't the media coverage that we have now. There's no video, there's no TV, you know, not everybody even has newspapers. So most people haven't even seen what he looks like, including some of these police officers. Some of them might have seen him, but some of them haven't. Most of them haven't. So, you know, how do you know which one is him and which one is just Joe Blow street, you know? So I kind of accepted it from that era. If you made this now, his face would be plastered all over, you know, the TV screens and memes and the internet, you know, the social media, it would be all over it. So you'd say, well, right now, I don't know that just putting on glasses would help.
Well, and the one person who had seen him up close in the courtroom who should have been able to identify him couldn't, because he had his glasses.
Yes, exactly. The bumbling attorney, which, again, I just want to touch on that. I found the scene with the attorney going over the fence with him to be quite amusing, how the guy was just basically selling him down the river. Oh, that's news. No, that's quite bad. You know,
I he was really oblivious to the fact that his client disappeared. Like, they were, like, they thought he escaped, and they're trying to find him. He has no clue this has even happened.
Yeah.
No, because he's sitting at the desk trying to find his glasses to be prepared to give evidence.
Trying to read the documents, holding them like a centimeter in front of his face.
I think you could change that sentence from he had no clue that this happened to he had no clue. He was just a clue. He was written as a clueless person. And, you know, it just shows you just being a lawyer doesn't mean you're intelligent. So any other points on this before we rate it?
Maybe just the comment that when it was ported to the U.S., they took out the blind man's bluff game, which is how they escaped the ant's house, which frustrated Hitchcock because that was one of his favorite scenes. Or, you know, how they escape the kid's birthday party. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple edits, but yeah.
I enjoyed the fact that she had people who believed in her judgment enough. Her father was willing to quit his job because he believed in her judgment. You know, I think in most stories, they would have him confronting her and saying, you need to go and turn yourself in and, you know, make sure that, you know, you don't get in trouble for allying yourself with this murderer. You know, that I think that's the way the traditional story would go. So I like the fact that at 18 years old, and the girl was young, I think, you know, that it was an acknowledgement of her level of intelligence and sophistication. And I like that about this movie. So I think I'm going to provide my rating as somebody who fancies himself as a fan of Alfred Hitchcock and a fan of filmmaking and a fan of film history, as opposed to, you know, a kid who's just going to the movies to see a film. With that perspective, I think I feel comfortable giving this a Jaws 2. If you're somebody who doesn't like older movies because of the production values, or, well, just doesn't like older movies, then maybe this falls down to a Jaws 3 for you. But for me, quite firmly in a Jaws 2 ranking.
I'm going to give it a Jaws 3.
Because you don't like old movies.
That's right. No, I do like old movies. I feel like maybe I, like I said, without knowing that the book existed, I feel like I wanted this to be the book and not the movie we got. Like I said, even for the period, some of the performances in this felt old-fashioned to me. I struggled with some of the plot conveniences. Again, it's not a bad movie, and I'm glad that I watched it. I don't know that I would ever say I'm in the mood for a Hitchcock film. Let me put on Young and Innocent. And that's why I give it a 3 instead of a 2.
I'm going to go with High Jaws 3 for me. And I teeter-tottered between them. I at one point in time, I put it at Jaws 2 myself. And it was the draw for me for this film is the characters. I really like the people. The character of Erica is fantastic. I like her relationship with her family. We did develop, you know, what that all looked like. Whereas her relationship with her aunt, I like that the aunt was questioning, like, this is odd behavior. There's something going on here. I thought that whole sequence played out really, really well. And I thought her character was very well developed. I liked the chemistry between them. The mystery itself, though, I felt was weak. Just it's a personal piece off of that. I think this is a great precursor to Hitchcock's later adventure films. I've referenced North by Northwest before. And I think from a film, if you enjoy film, you should see this. It's fun. There's something fun to be had here. But I'm going to say High Jaws 3 because I feel like I'm recommending watching it for those reasons, but not because I feel that it's a Jaws 2 movie. And that's... I enjoyed watching this. I'm glad we're doing this because I think it's a film I wouldn't have seen otherwise. I may watch it again just because I had fun with my time with the characters. I watched it twice now, and I wouldn't be against watching it a third time. But with the draw would have to be watching it with somebody who hasn't seen it before and wants to see it from those perspectives. I'm going with High Jaws 3.
Yeah. Okay. So everyone's made all the arguments, and that's part of why I was struggling, because when I was thinking about how to rank it myself, you know, the idea that it would be, I guess, Psycho 1 or Psycho 4, neither of those rankings occurred to me. Right. The question was always, is it a 2 or 3? Mm-hmm. And I mean, if someone said, hey, I want to watch one of Hitchcock's Man on the Run films, this is not the one I'd point them to. Right. If you want to show how a filmmaker can learn from things and say, okay, watch all of Hitchcock's Man on the Run films, this will be on that list. I can't imagine someone who enjoys movies from the 30s watching this and then regretting that they watched it. Right. If you enjoy mm-hmm. movies of the era in general, you'll probably enjoy this one. But it also, I mean, we talked about that one great shot. It's one great shot. My edit is 82 minutes, and we're talking about maybe a minute of footage that is really breaking new ground. So, like Sean said, there's a lot of enjoyable moments. I did really like the fact that the aunt was not an idiot. She's going, no, something is up. And they only get away because the uncle intervenes and gives them that opportunity. Right. The sequence played out well. I see why Hitchcock regretted that it was removed, because it also wasn't that short. So how much movie was left when they turned it into The Girl Was Young instead of Young and Innocent? But yeah, I ended up landing... I don't know, I've gone back and forth even during this conversation. Is a very low 2 or a very high 3? And I think I'm going to end up on the very low 2. But it, you ask me again 3 hours from now, and I might come out the other way. It's just really close to that border for me.
I'm just going to throw into the discussion that justifying my own my own rate that I did watch it a second time, and I actually enjoyed it more the second time. So I feel it does have the rewatchability mm-hmm. aspect. And as I mentioned earlier, in the colorized version, when they show the shots at the beach, and when they show the shots of them on the run, there is a real quality to shots that I couldn't appreciate in the black and white version, but somehow they stood out to me in the color version. So just being a fan to some extent of filmmaking in general, it gave me an appreciation for what Hitchcock did as far as framing the shots and all, even though I couldn't really see it as much in the black and white version. And again, the colorization was poorly done, but it still gave me an appreciation for those shots. And I think that brought it up a level for me. And just some of the characters, I felt they were realized in a good way, and they were not tropes for the most part. And I think often when we're going back to movies of this era, we have a sensation where, oh, this is all stereotype stuff, because sometime between 1937 and now, these things became standard. In this instance, I think it went away from some of the stereotypes, and it presented people differently. Again, like I said, the fact that her family trusted her uncle and her father enough to back up her judgment in it. So there's things about it that I just really, really enjoyed, and I feel like I'm comfortable with my Jaws 2 ranking, despite you people just shooting it down.
No, totally fair. So, like I said, it's almost a coin toss for me between 2 and 3. This.
No, I got you. So that's it for the young and innocent. We're going to move on to old and guilty. But what are we doing next time, Blaine?
Next time it is The Birds. So not to be confused with The Burbs.
Yeah, I don't think Hitchcock had a lot to do with that one.
No, but I do remember that when my sister took visual communication as an option in junior high, and the teacher said, okay, we're going to be watching The Birds next time. A lot of the class got excited because they loved that Tom Hanks movie. And then he popped this in, and they realized, oh, they completely misheard what he said, and it was not what they were looking for. So
is that Joe Dante?
Could be.
Yeah. It is. That's, I think, right. It is.
Anyway, so if you haven't seen The Birds yet and you want to watch it before our next Is It Psycho rating, and we did give it Jaws ratings. We just change all of those to Psycho if you're listening. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you guys for doing this with us, and see you next time. Bye-bye.